You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, The Idris Experience by K. Austin Collins, with photographs by Collier Shore, styled by Ludovine Pueblin. Rumors of his serving as the next 007 have taken on a strange and outsized place in Elba's professional narrative these last few years, and with good reason. It would be an ideal role for Elba, you'd think. Speculation that Elba would be hired as the first black James Bond was sparked in part by a 2018 survey in The Hollywood Reporter claiming that 63% of Americans wanted him for the role, a reflection of, if nothing else, the changing times. It always seemed to have been more a matter of the will of the people than of actual prospects. He was, by all accounts, never seriously considered. Elba confirms for me that this is not happening and adds that he doesn't love to talk about it. James Bond is a hugely coveted, iconic, beloved character that takes audiences on this massive escapism journey, he says. Of course, if someone said to me, "Do you want to play James Bond?" I'd be like, "Yeah, that's fascinating to me." But it's not something I've expressed, like, "Yeah, I want to be the black James Bond." He now has fun with the rumor mongering, riling up fans with 007-esque tweets and a selfie with Daniel Craig. It's almost disappointing. The idea of a black 007 is intriguing, even opportune for a narrative shakedown or two. Picture it, a Bond whose advantages include not being the white guy everyone thinks they're hunting for, but someone black, or a woman, or both. Blaxploitation movies used to make fun of scenarios like this, as have countless undercover cop movies. Because, by the way, Elba says, we're talking about a spy. If you really want to break it down, the more less obvious it is, the better. Which hasn't made him any more eager to have the conversation. Here, his nonchalance wavers a little. You just get disheartened, he says, when you get people from a generational point of view going, it can't be. And it really turns out to be the color of my skin. And then if I get it, and it didn't work, or it did work, would it be because of the color of my skin? That's a difficult position to put myself into when I don't need to. Not that it really matters. Elba isn't exactly lacking for world-conquering franchises on his resume. Not even George Clooney, an actor famous for transitioning from a mega-successful TV career to an incomparable run as a matinee idol and box office star, has had quite as varied a Hollywood studio arc as Elba, though that has as much to do with movie stardom in the 21st century as anything else. This is the franchise era. In 1997, Clooney did a Batman movie, survived it barely, and moved on. Elba, by contrast, has had a funny habit of popping up in seemingly every variety of these tentpoles with a fluidness that is probably matched only by Zoe Saldana, Avatar, Marvel, and Star Trek. He's wound his way through the Alien franchise, Prometheus, the Marvel Universe, the Thor trilogy and beyond, Star Trek, Finding Dory, a live-action remake of a classic animated Disney film, The Jungle Book, and Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim, though he was not in its sequel. In an intriguing example of the kind of race-blind casting the 007 movies haven't yet learned to imitate with their most iconic role. He starred in the 2017 adaptation of Stephen King's The Dark Tower as the mysterious gunslinger locked in eternal battle with Matthew McConaughey. The movie, which is better than you've probably heard, tanked. But Elba, gruff and jaded in a riff on bygone Western sharpshooters, mixed with more than a little samurai grace, made a case for himself as a genuine star, the kind of person you want to watch in any genre, doing anything. Race-blind casting is a necessary good for the obvious reasons. Movies aren't real. Most roles can be played by a wide range of shapes, sizes, and skin colors. And our attachment to white actors as cultural defaults has resulted in a lot of samey, boring art, to say nothing of the countless stagnant careers of talented non-white actors everywhere. Elba seems particularly proud of his work in the Thor films for that reason. He plays the all-seeing, all-hearing Heimdall, protector of Asgard, a role that the comics, he notes, have typically depicted as a Norse god, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, flowing hair. Suddenly, you realize that black kids read comics, he says. That whole skater fanboy crowd, well, black people love these things too. He got the role by audition. Kenneth Branagh, who directed the first one, just said, "I love you as an actor. I'm going to give you this role." Elba says he's not IP obsessed. "I don't sit and go, I'm going to take this role because it's franchisable," he says. On the other hand, he's also an actor, and to the extent that ego is involved in these choices, he's self-aware. I think it's one of those pinnacle things that actors strive towards, to have that one character where people go, "Ah." And it branches off into its own universe and fan base. Every actor loves the idea of having their own franchise. For him, it has been Luther, the BBC detective show about the brash, impulsive, frequently out-of-line detective John Luther, in which Elba gets to flex a familiar muscle, but as the lead, grounding the show's constant moral vicissitudes in a man we disapprove of, even as we root him on. The show is now in its fifth season, and will perhaps someday be a movie. "I'd love to see 3 or 4 Luthers come out as films, definitely," says Elba. It doesn't escape him, by the way, that when there was once talk of an American Luther, every kind of person was considered, every race, gender, and so on. It was just whether they could pull off the role, Elba says, a matter of who was good enough to fill his shoes as the troubled, wearisome, satisfyingly deviant John Luther. The project never moved forward. What is it that we want to see from Idris Elba? If the legacy of his work as Stringer Bell resulted in parallel but distinct mainstream and black-focused strands in his career, it also solidified a reliable character archetype that, if for no other reason than because he's so good at it, Elba keeps exploring. In other words, the bad guy. Admit it. You like to see Idris Elba break bad. Or baddish, anyway. You can see how we got here. Bell was a bad guy, a drug hustler, but you almost couldn't help but like him as you hated him. Co-star Michael K. Williams, whose Omar Little has cast an equally large shadow over his career, likened Elba to a sparring partner. "Whenever he saw Elba's name on a call sheet, I went over my notes extra hard, and I dotted all my I's and made sure all my T's were crossed." A distinction he afforded only a handful of other actors in the show's stacked cast. He cried in the makeup trailer before filming Elba's last scene. Bell was largely based on Lamont Chin Farmer, whom co-creator Ed Burns had once, in his time with Baltimore PD, investigated, and helped prosecute. Simon told me that the real Stringer Bell was a man Burns had admired. The thoughtfulness with which he proceeded in masking his criminal activity, says Simon, he was a very shrewd, very thoughtful, very quiet player. Hence Elba's characterization. Handsome, reserved, curiously professional. A guy who approached the project corners with MBA-level discipline, which made him all the more insidious in criminal terms. Elba's charm had a funny way of exploiting that tension. Simon describes it as existing between a layer of street arrogance and confidence on one hand, and something underneath it that's contradictory on the other, some broader intellectual and psychological force at work. This was a strong counterpoint to the more dangerous live wire Avon Barksdale, the role Elba originally auditioned for. Ultimately, it went to the great Wood Harris. Elba tells me that it all boils down to his upbringing. His depiction of Bell was somewhat based on a guy he knew growing up, a local weed man who went by the Gent, whose attitude was amicable, professional, discreet. The weed man, says Elba, in terms of being portrayed, was always like, he lowers his voice to a grumble, big and larger than life cat daddy. But Elba is English, understated, stiff upper lip. He preferred to play it differently, beyond the terms of good and bad. He was there to provide a service. I'm out here selling bricks, he says. Not bricks. I'm out here selling fine furniture, not fine furniture. You know? Even in his newest film, the upcoming Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw, a spin-off of the internationally beloved Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel franchise, Elba plays a bad guy who was, you guessed it, once a good guy. Brixton is his name, though everyone in the movie's trailers calls him Black Superman because he's genetically enhanced and apparently unstoppable. For director David Leitch, Elba was a no-contest choice. I think when you're looking for someone who can be a formidable adversary for Dwayne Johnson, that's difficult enough, says Leitch. But then you're looking for someone who can be a formidable adversary for Dwayne Johnson plus Jason Statham. That list gets really short. The actor is, again, not a franchise nut. Still, he tells me, I secretly feel like I could make him into a huge character. He likes playing bad guys. He likes the complexity of those roles. And he's liking his recent spate of action movie roles, too, which demand a different form of imagination than the usual. And looking beyond the usual, trying new things, keeps him hungry. He doesn't want to be typecast. Hence, Cats. Alongside Sir Ian McKellen and Dame Judi Dench and Taylor Swift, in which, to be clear, he still plays a bad guy, cat. McCavity, of whom T.S. Eliot, author of Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, on which the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical is based, wrote, "He's broken every human law. He breaks the law of gravity. His powers of levitation would make a fakir stare." The mind reels, wondering what Elba will do with the role. Breaking the law of gravity. I have just seen Elba play a frying egg up close, and I am still not prepared. Cats director Tom Hooper has long been a fan of Elba's, particularly in light of his work as Stringer Bell, and had him in mind from his very first draft. What excited him in this case were Elba's other dimensions. In his other work, I'd also seen glimpses of another side to him, a more mischievous comedic side, Hooper says. When he and Elba were thinking up a model for the character, Jack Nicholson, who has that ability to be scary and comedic and unpredictable in the same moment, says Hooper, came to mind. Elba has given it a lot of thought. The myth is that cats have 9 lives, and he, McCavity, has 1 left. So he's desperate to be acknowledged, and he's slightly unhinged. And he's obviously met death a few times and gotten past it. The character has complexities, and I think that Tom Hooper wanted someone who could pull off that stuff, meanwhile singing and dancing and meowing. I suspect he can meow. Can he sing? I'm not a singer, he says, reminding me that he's a professional musician. I've made music with singing. I'm musical. So no, he's not a singer per se, and he didn't see himself starring in Cats until it came time to star in Cats, hence the appeal. I'm an actor, he says. I've never done it before, so I thought, why not? He played it cool with me, but according to Hooper, Elba's excitement was palpable. It turned out he had always had a dream of being in a musical, which I didn't know, says the director. So Idris got his dream, and he got his dream with Taylor Swift. Well, why not? We're watching Elba's career explode in real time, and Cats is an enticingly odd cog in that narrative. Rather, we think we're watching it in real time. Not just his acting career, that Coachella set, the kind of opportunity a DJ works toward for years, was a high point in Elba's long haul as a professional musician. A few years before that, he had a gig at Glastonbury. He had a key leading man benchmark this year when he was invited to host Saturday Night Live. And just last year, he'd made it to the cover of People's Sexiest Man Alive, the first black man to do so since Washington in 1996. It's as if, all at once, we've realized he's big league, a mainstream, top-of-the-line success, the kind of actor who can headline 2017's The Mountain Between Us, an icebound, stranded two-hander co-starring Kate Winslet, and maybe pop off a fantasy franchise with Matthew McConaughey, and then rumble with The Rock. Elba is aware of how that looks. He's aware of the pitfalls of what seems, from the outside, like a sudden catapult from medium to mainstream success. The experience of it was, of course, different. You know that whole Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, he says? I had put my work in, and so, yeah, it was sort of like crawl, 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 stop, crawl, run. It really was that for me. He'd been a working actor for almost 9 years before breaking out on The Wire, and though many people have only recently become aware of how serious he is about music, a tidbit often used to spice up magazine profiles, this is no mere hobby. It's easy to write off actors' secondary careers, be they music or a fashion line, as privileged diversion or mere brand enhancement. And, well, plenty of people putz around on drum sets and turntables in their free time. But this new arc in his music career has been 4 or 5 years in the making, Elba reminds me. And this current slate of new releases in theaters and on TV was largely filmed scattershot before 2019. But the calendar happened to work out this year in a way that makes it easy to forget the 3 or 4 years when, after coming to the U.S., he was unemployed and losing out on parts to Omar Epps, Don Cheadle, Boris Kodjo, and Taye Diggs, or the years when he simply didn't seem to be everywhere at once. It's interesting to talk to an actor at this stage of his career about his insecurities, in part because confronting and embracing insecurity is part of the work. Take Saturday Night Live, a live show pitched, written, and rehearsed within a week, in a genre that, despite his humorous behind-the-scenes persona, which is visible on Instagram, and his brief but hilarious stint on The Office, isn't necessarily seen as his bag, even if it should be. Elba enjoyed being on the program. It was fun. It was really hard work. Honest hard work. He likes that. But he also had to open himself up. I found that, you know, the more I just plugged in and jumped headfirst in and just exposed myself and my insecurities to anything, the better it was for me as an experience, he says. He shows his insecurities to us all the time. We likely don't experience it in quite those terms, but Elba does. You're throwing yourself out there for people to pick at you, or steer you, or tell you their opinion, or laugh at you, or celebrate you, he says. Whatever those are, you're definitely amplifying that. Growing comfortable in that space isn't easy for him, or anyone. Just look at other actors. Daniel Day-Lewis is an incredible actor, Elba says, but does not like to be in the public eye and manages to do the two. I can't do that. I wish I could. I wish I could just be obscure and no one ever have to see me and never have to do interviews and still have the career that he has. This is part of what makes celebrity in the 21st century uniquely difficult. Day-Lewis was already an Oscar winner by the time Elba arrived on the scene. He'd likely have faced a different climate coming up today in an age of social media, where an engaged and personable performer like Elba is expected to wield his online clout in one way or another. As you climb up the ladder, he says, people expect you to have way more followers, and you become the marketing engine. There used to be a day where I could have no followers and still get paid, and people still expect me to do press. But if I come along with 8 million followers, and they're all going to see my movie, the film companies want that, so the pressure to be more public is higher. Gone, in other words, are the days of saying whatever the F I wanted on Twitter. And if you take a picture of you or your house, do know that there are people zooming in to see what's behind you, he says. That stuff, you have to think about it way more than people back in the day. He doesn't love it, but he's mastered it. When we talk again in a few weeks, Coachella has come and gone, and so has the actor's 3-day Morocco wedding, a private event made public by virtue of who Elba is, with splashy photos published in British Vogue and the collectively disappointed sigh of woeful admirers around the world. He met Sabrina Dari at a party in Toronto while filming The Mountain Between Us, which can't help but feel somehow quaint, even normal. That seems to be the ideal. Everything's a balance in life, Elba says. I have to do the work because it's a popular time for me, and it's best to have that. But also, I'm madly in love with my wife and my children. They're his priority, still. Not fame, not persona, but the Canning Town boy become man. And the people he loves. At home, I'm not famous. I'm me, he says. And to my team and my family and the people that I work with every day when we build what we build, we're not famous. You know what I mean? It's day one. Every day. Thank you. Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit, October 21st through the 23rd, 2019, Los Angeles, Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. 2 days and two nights of newsmaking insights, invaluable connections, and unmatched events brought to life with Vanity Fair's signature style. For more information and to request an invitation, visit vfsummit.com. To the fairground, beyond the sea, from the famed cliffside perch at the Hotel du Cap Edenrau, Vanity Fair and Chopard celebrated the Stars of Cannes by Britt Hennemuth, with photographs by Justin Bishop. David Geffen parked his yacht in the Mediterranean to rub shoulders on shore with Cannes staples Charlotte Casarighi, Alfonso Cuarón, and Pamela Anderson. The dance floor became a lively refuge from a dramatic rainstorm as Chris Tucker, Salma Hayek, and Shailene Woodley grooved to the Rolling Stones and Prince. Newly minted Batman Robert Pattinson made his first appearance after rumors swirled that he had won the role, holding court with Quentin Tarantino in town to debut his new film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. In the photos, the Hotel du Cap Edenrau in Antibes, France, Willem Dafoe and Salma Hayek, David Geffen, Taylor Hill and Miles Teller, Nick Jonas and Priyanka Chopra, Luca Guadagnino and Shailene Woodley, Antonio Banderas, Chris Tucker, Chopard's Desiree Galas, Radhika Jones, Daniela Pick, and Quentin Tarantino.
Thank you.
Windsors of Change, Newlywed Travels, Big Plans, Life with Master Archie, Vanity Fair Royal Correspondent Katie Nicol dishes on a year in the life of the Sussexes. Opening photos, grand parentage, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, and her son, Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor, with Prince Philip. Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, Queen Elizabeth and Meghan's mother, Doria Ragland. Master Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor was just 2 days old when he met the entire world. Swaddled in a cashmere shawl, the seventh in line to the British throne, slept through his historic debut photo call. The Duchess of Sussex, elegant and simply attired in a bespoke white dress that deliberately showed off her postpartum body, had styled herself and done her own nails, hair, and makeup, all minimalist as well. The message, according to a friend, was, "I'm a real woman." Harry, who proudly cradled their little bundle of joy, showed no signs of nerves. 2 days in, and he had, says a pal, mastered the art of diaper changing. He is changing nappies and giddy with joy, absolutely over the moon. The couple has rewritten the royal script with nearly every public engagement and appearance since they met 3 years ago. Archie is now the tiniest change agent in the family, as the first biracial dual-heritage baby to be born to the 100-year-old House of Windsor. And the way his parents have gone about his introduction to the world speaks volumes about the new mold of royal they are creating. The couple's marriage, Meghan's pregnancy, and the birth of Archie have set a flurry of precedents. There was the debut photo shoot itself. Meghan hadn't felt comfortable with the idea of parading her baby so soon after the birth. They had chosen not to use the Queen's medics or have the baby at the Lindo Wing at St. Mary's Hospital, where Princess Diana had William and Harry, and where the Duchess of Cambridge delivered her three babies. In another bold new move, Meghan had decided that if she could, she wanted a home birth. But when Archie was a week overdue, they were taken to the Portland Hospital in central London in a cloak-and-dagger operation. It was, according to one source, an uncomplicated delivery. The couple had decided to keep the details of the birth private and were able to enjoy 9 hours of newborn bliss before informing the world of Archie's arrival via their official Instagram account. "It's a boy" went out to 8 million followers before the town crier officially rang in the birth. In another unusual move, which was welcomed by royalists around the world, the Sussexes released an intimate photo of their son with his great-grandmother and grandmother, the Queen and Meghan's mother, Doria Ragland, whose presence signaled not only her inclusion within the royal family, but also how closely involved in little Archie's life she will be. She was with the couple when Meghan gave birth. In the end, there was no doula, and although she was not in the family portrait, Diana seemed present, in Harry's palpable joy, and in just how far he has pushed the restrictive bounds of royalty. The Queen, according to a friend of the family, was delighted to be a great-grandmother for the 8th time. Not so long ago, she joked that she probably wouldn't be around to see Harry have children, but here she is at the age of 93, welcoming another baby. Indeed, Archie's arrival caps a momentous year for the Sussexes, who celebrated their first wedding anniversary on May 19th. The Sussexes are glittering gems in the monarchy's crown. Their debut tour of Australia, where the announcement of their pregnancy caused a news frenzy, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands of Fiji and Tonga last fall, was considered a triumph for the royal family in boosting its image overseas. Harry and Meghan were praised for being warm, natural, and most of all, accessible. They mingled happily with crowds at times 10 deep, proof, if it were needed, of their global popularity. At home in Britain, they have spent the year not only in the spotlight, but shining it on the causes they care deeply about, including conservation, issues facing young people, gender equality, and mental health. Next, photos, baby love, Harry and Meghan in Fiji during a royal tour last October. Archie, 2 days old, in May. Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, and Meghan at Wimbledon last July. Meghan has taken on 4 patronages since becoming a royal, including 2 from the Queen, a mark of the monarch's respect and affection for her daughter-in-law, and courtiers say more will be announced before the end of the year. In their engagement interview, they said they wanted to hit the ground running. Meghan worked through the 8th month of pregnancy, packing in a whistle-stop tour to Morocco after her celebrity-studded baby shower in New York. Harry was back at work within days of becoming a father, flying to the Netherlands to launch the countdown to the 2020 Invictus Games, visiting a children's hospital, and playing a charity polo match in Rome. There were events in his diary that were important to him and which he wanted to honor, says an aide, but he is taking time to be with his family. During President Donald Trump's state visit in early June, Harry was present for official functions, while Meghan stayed out of the picture, leading to speculation she had intentionally avoided Trump, who called her nasty for having once labeled him misogynistic and divisive. Had Meghan not been on maternity leave, she would have been there alongside Harry. There was no snub. This wasn't personal, a source close to the Duchess says. She would never let personal feelings come in the way of duty. Harry, meanwhile, joined Trump and the Queen for lunch at Buckingham Palace on the first day of the state visit. This was only the Duke's 2nd state visit, so it was an interesting upgrade to have a place at the table, notes a courtier. Though Meghan won't go back to work full-time until later in the year, she did make an appearance at Trooping the Colour and will be present at a few other key events before October. The Queen has been astonished and very impressed by Meghan's work drive, reveals a royal source. There's a feeling that Meghan likes to be busy and must be kept busy. She's very driven. Aides are looking at early plans for the family to take a series of sabbaticals overseas before Archie starts school. While reports that the couple plan to move overseas have been denied by the palace, the couple's aides have confirmed they are in discussions about traveling abroad for short periods of time. Months, not years, suggests an aide. There have been conversations in a workshopping way, but there's no suggestion of moving to another country, says the aide, adding that the couple will undertake a 2-week tour to southern Africa in October. They will travel to Botswana, Malawi, and Angola, and plan to take Archie and his new nanny with them. Harry and Meghan, who have been lined up as ambassadors for the Commonwealth and are president and vice president, respectively, of the Queen's Commonwealth Trust, are said to be keen to learn more about conservation, a joint passion, and the challenges facing young people in the Commonwealth. According to a family friend, it is the Sussexes' ambition to be roving royals. They want to travel and to be international. With the recent creation of a new household for the Sussexes, which will be independent of the Cambridge's court at Kensington Palace, the future roles of all 4 royals are being mapped out in the corridors of power. While William is preparing to succeed his father, Prince Charles, as the next Prince of Wales, and eventually to become king with Kate as his queen consort, Harry and Meghan are establishing their own court under the umbrella of the Queen's household at Buckingham Palace. The operation will require a delicate hand. Courtiers are aware of the Sussexes' global popularity and are keen that they do not eclipse the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. "We are further down in the pecking order," affirms a Sussex aide. Nevertheless, in a recent poll, Harry was voted the most popular royal after his grandmother. It has not helped optics that there have been reports of behind-the-scenes feuds and rivalry between the two camps, which gained momentum when Kensington Palace announced earlier this year that the Sussexes were moving out of Harry's childhood home for a new life in Windsor. The move gave the Sussexes more physical space and privacy. Frogmore Cottage is nestled in 655-acre home park, but emotions were just as much at play. Harry wanted to branch out, to be his own person. There were reports of a froideur between the two duchesses, with one report alleging that Meghan had reduced Kate to tears in the run-up to the royal wedding during a dress fitting for Princess Charlotte. A source maintains that although the women are not particularly close, there was no real falling out between them. There was, however, a genuine rift between the princes that had been brewing since Harry's engagement to Meghan. According to a friend of the brothers, they fell out after William voiced his concerns that Harry's relationship with Meghan was moving too quickly. "William had concerns, and Harry resented that," says the friend. Harry also felt that William and Kate hadn't made enough effort with Meghan. At one stage, the situation between Harry and William was so strained that they were not on speaking terms, but things have been much better since Archie's arrival. Having their own courts has, aides say, also alleviated tensions. Kensington Palace is small in comparison to Buckingham Palace, where Harry and Meghan will be able to spread their wings independently of William and Kate. They are in the process of forming their household, essentially their working headquarters, and where their staff will be based. Next photos, family ties. Meghan and the Queen at a civic ceremony in Cheshire last June. William, the Duke of Cambridge. Harry, Meghan, and Catherine at Westminster Abbey for a World War I centenary last November. Harry in The Hague for the Invictus Games launch with a gift from Princess Margriet of the Netherlands. The Sussexes will also have a suite of rooms at the palace for when they need to stay in the capital, in keeping with other members of the royal family who have offices at Buckingham Palace. They have already hired a communications secretary, Sarah Latham, an American and former senior advisor on Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, with whom Meghan gets along well. They are in the process of recruiting a private secretary, an assistant private secretary for Meghan, a digital editor, and at least two press officers. It will be crucial to the couple's success that they are supported by a hard-working, loyal team. At Kensington Palace, the Duchess earned a reputation among some courtiers for being difficult and demanding. Her habit of sending 5 a.m. emails to staff saw her nicknamed Hurricane Meghan, and there was an unusually high turnover of palace staff. 5 to date since Meghan's arrival, including 2 private assistants who allegedly quit under the pressures of the job, and the Duchess's head of security, a woman whose name has never been released by Kensington Palace. The couple's interim private secretary, Samantha Cohen, is due to leave imminently, while assistant private secretary Amy Pickerel left the royal household on amicable terms shortly before Archie's birth. Meghan has had to navigate her own personal drama with her family back in the States and has suffered in the tabloids as a result, so she is said to want a new approach when it comes to PR. Close friends, including Oprah Winfrey, George Clooney, makeup artist Daniel Martin, and CBS anchor Gayle King, have all spoken out in defense of Meghan. Courtiers say the Duchess has remained positive by not reading any press, good or bad, and by leaning on her husband, who is 100% devoted. The papers like to use the word difficult. I'd say different, says someone who works closely with the Duchess. It was hard for her. She didn't have a support structure in place, and she was getting used to living in a new country and being part of a very unique institution. She has settled in, though, and as she prepares to become a British citizen, sources close to Meghan say she has adopted Britishisms. She says pantsless, and I've heard her say bits and bobs, notes a source. Friends say Harry has changed for the better since meeting Meghan. Once a royal rebel, he now starts his mornings with a green juice, blended by Meghan, and practices meditation. He has quit smoking and rarely drinks alcohol. Their life at Frogmore is one of domestic bliss, amazingly ordinary. It's like their private oasis and sanctuary, says a friend. It's lovely and cozy, and they are very happy there. A wedding present from the Queen, the cottage, which is more of a grand country house, is situated on the grounds of Frogmore, where the couple celebrated their wedding party. According to an aide, they spent a lot of time in Windsor during their courtship and love it. It's also close to Heathrow, which makes it handy for the Duchess's mother to fly into. Built as a retreat for Queen Charlotte, the house is steeped in history. Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, and his wife Wallis Simpson, the last American divorcee to marry into the royal family, are buried on the grounds of Frogmore House, while Frogmore Cottage was once the home of Queen Victoria's beloved attendant Abdul Karim, the Munshi. The Queen, who is likely to be a regular visitor, loves the gardens at Frogmore, where she picks flowers for her desk. Until recently, the cottage was used as staff accommodation. However, it was converted into a 5-bedroom house for the Sussexes, following an extensive, taxpayer-funded, £3 million renovation. They moved in just weeks before Archie was born. The rebuild includes eco-friendly heating and water systems, new fireplaces, Meghan adores log fires, and staircases, as well as the yoga studio with a spring floor and a state-of-the-art kitchen. Harry, who is into gadgets, has had the nursery said to be painted in gray and white tones with vegan paints, kitted out with a state-of-the-art sound system. An adjoining room is for their nanny, who is one of just a handful of staff. The couple want a scaled-down entourage and won't be hiring anything like what the Cambridges have, according to an aide who points out that the Sussexes don't have the same financial resources as the Cambridges, for starters. While they have hired a housekeeper and have two assistants to help them out, as well as the shared services of two palace orderlies, their entourage is low-key compared to other senior royals. Meghan is actually pretty down-to-earth, says a member of her team. The couple do not have a chef, and Meghan does the cooking. She prepared organic meals before the baby was born and froze them, knowing she would be busy. Rather than hire a baby nurse, which is increasingly popular in the U.S., she relied on her mother, Doria, to help out during the first weeks. And instead of hiring a trainer to get back into shape, Meghan did yoga with Doria, already a certified yogi, who took a course in postnatal yoga. The couple love being outdoors, and they take Archie for long pram walks in Home Park. Although due to their hectic schedules, they are privately advertising for a dog walker for their black Labrador and Meghan's rescue dog, Guy. For the most part, they are self-sufficient. Megan doesn't have a stylist. She does most of it herself, says a source, adding that Megan also does all the grocery shopping online. While she has her favorite Fortnum and Mason Royal Blend tea delivered as a treat for guests, her weekly delivery is not so grand. More like Ocado, says a friend. Ocado is a UK equivalent to Fresh Direct, noting that Kate and Megan have similar taste when it comes to shopping. They are able to have a private family life, which is so important to them, says charity campaigner Nick Ead, who has worked with Megan. When Megan first came to England, she fell in love with the countryside. She loves English pubs, a roaring fire, and country walks. Megan still keeps in touch with a lot of her old friends, and many of them have children, so I can see her hosting playdates, organizing tea parties, and very stylish dinner parties, too. It will be a proper family home. As he gets older, Archie will enjoy a privileged life, swimming at the indoor pool at Windsor Castle and learning to ride on the Queen's horses. Harry is said to be keen to enroll him in one of the prestigious local polo clubs. There is a nearby farm park, and tea at Windsor Castle on Sunday afternoon with the Queen will likely become a weekly ritual, as it did for Harry when he was a boy. Most important, having grown up in the spotlight, Harry is said to want an ordinary life for his son. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.